So, hello there. Welcome to the show. We have a special guest with us today. I'm going to absolutely butcher your name. I really apologize for this. Petty, is that right?
PD.
Petty, sorry. I apologize. So we have a new book out, which will be available. I will post links and things like that. And again, I'm going to apologize because this is about a French lady, and my French is shocking. So I'm going to try and pronounce this. Correct me if I'm wrong. Eugène de Monito.
Let's try it at Eugenie de Montijo.
There you go. See, butchered it. So we are talking about the last Empress of France, which for those of you who are new to the show, or those of you who have been with the show a long time, we've never really covered anyone in French history. So this is a first for me, and it's absolutely fascinating to have you on the show. So thank you for joining us and welcome.
Thank you, and I'm delighted to be able to do it.
Oh, well, we appreciate it, especially seeing as you're in France right now and it's a little bit later than it is in the UK. So I know you're staying up for this one. So
Well,
thank you very much.
happily, there's good coffee in France.
Oh, yeah, well, it's better than here. We do tea over here, but not coffee. So firstly, I want to know, because I've never actually heard of Eugenie before I got the book. So what made you did you know about her beforehand, or was it something you came across and just researched, or where did the inspiration come from?
Well, first of all, Dan, you're no different from, I guess, about 99.9% of the world in having never heard of her. Yes, I came across her originally when I was working with my husband Don on our Champagne Charlie book about the Frenchman who taught Americans to love champagne. In it, Charlie was held in prison in the United States during the US Civil War, and his wife, desperate to find a way to get him released, wrote to the Empress. She wrote to Eugenie. I was surprised to find that she'd written to the Empress and not to the Emperor. So I looked up Eugenie and became absolutely fascinated as I read more and more about her. And from that grew the idea of the book about this woman who had done so much, had included so many different things in her life that I guess it just seemed impossible to ignore her and to leave her in, shall we say, the dust of history.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, having read the book, and it's not someone I'd ever known about, like I said, and the amount of things that she's done in her life and the influences that she's had, but yet to still be forgotten, I find that fascinating. And especially the fact that, she has been overlooked throughout history, and I wonder why you think she's been overlooked. What's the reason?
The main reason, first of all, is that she was a female. During a time when men were very, very prominent in all parts of all walks of life. And then the second thing is that it was she who was in power when France lost the Franco-Prussian War. And I guess nobody really likes a loser.
Well, yes, no, I can agree with that one. I definitely agree. I mean, I do find, especially the woman thing, because I find that really fascinating with British history as well. Because when we look back through British history, I mean, I can rattle off very, very famous men, Walter Raleigh, Francis Drake, Nelson, the list goes on. When we talk about historical female characters, we go Queen Victoria, Queen Elizabeth, Queen Mary, and we sort of talk about the royal side of things. There's not that many women in British history that really stand out. I mean, for me, one of the main ones is Florence Nightingale, but there aren't those huge characters, and I wonder if that is because, talking back to sort of the 1800s, we are talking about a very patriarchal society, and I wonder with that. I mean, did Was she, would you class her as a feminist, a sort of a pioneer of that sort of movement at the time?
Definitely. She said very clearly that one of the things she wanted to do was fight what she called sex prejudice, which obviously is fighting as a feminist. And she supported all kinds of feminist interests, feminist programs, although the name hadn't been created yet. She was very, very active in France, getting I think maybe the most important thing, getting French women the right to be educated, which until that time had meant only that they learned how to embroider well and perhaps know the Bible. Oh, and the lives of saints.
So, so with her being in that sort of position, what do you think that helped? Obviously being the Empress. I mean, we're talking quite a long period. I mean, she was alive for she had quite a long life, really.
She lived to be 94, yes.
94. Yeah, I mean, she died. Was it 1920?
That's right,
Yeah.
yes.
So
She
we're
lived
talking.
the way through the First World War, right?
Which is crazy when you're talking about someone who was a member of Napoleon's house, household, Napoleon's household. You're talking
Right.
Trafalgar, Waterloo, and the First World War. And that's a seriously that you know, and then to think the woman who a woman who lived through all of this has
Right.
been forgotten.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean,
Not
I think that's
exactly.
crazy.
But what you're saying about history looking very much until very recently as a sort of top-down experience. The people at the top, who, in other words, the men who ruled, were the ones you find in history. And very often there is a lot more going on than just a few people sitting at the top of the heap.
Absolutely. I mean, they say if it's what behind every great man is a great woman. I'm a great believer of that, and my wife would back me up 100% with that one. So,
Well, I don't know. I generally feel that behind every great woman, there's a pretty good man.
yeah, I do you know what I would you've got I've got you with that one. I agree totally. I mean, like I say, I find this type of history, I find this very fascinating because it's not something I'm very well versed in. And especially with it being French, like I said, when we talk for British, when we speak about the French, we kind of only talk about the times where Britain has beaten France. I mean, we kind of leave out the other things. So, I mean, she was obviously part of the Napoleonic household, part of the House of Bonaparte.
Right.
Correct me if I'm wrong. She was quite a pioneer when we come to talk about fashion and perfume and things like that. I mean, they still talk about that type of things now. Am I right in saying that?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. She really created the haute couture industry, which, while you may think of it as pretty dresses, etc., is a major economic factor in the economy of France, now in the economy of the world. It was because she worked well with a British designer, Charles Frederick Worth, to make this an important aspect of her reign, should I say, because she really understood that she wanted to sell France, and to sell France, she had to sell good things. She had to sell things that attracted people. She became essentially a brand ambassador for France. And because she was very attractive, she could wear very beautiful gowns and make everyone notice her, notice the gowns, want to imitate what she was doing, sort of the beginning of celebrity culture.
Yeah, I mean, and I believe that she used to wear quite a few gowns as well. I mean, there never was a gown worn twice, and
That's
four
right.
gowns a day, I believe, breakfast.
Yeah.
I mean,
You
that's
know,
a little
I.
bit crazy, but and these are massive gowns. I mean, when you talk about France now, I mean, I think one of the main things when we talk about France, we do talk about fashion. They have Fashion Week in France. Paris Fashion Week's one of the most famous in the world. It's huge for designer clothes, and this woman was essentially one of the pioneers of that. I mean, it's crazy to think.
Yeah.
So In regards to her, obviously, like you said, she was very beautiful. She was a very attractive woman. This probably isn't on topic, but I want to know, with her changing dresses so much, and these dresses don't look comfortable, how did she sit for these portraits? I mean,
I don't know how she found time for half the things she did. The woman seemed to have more energy than an entire room of other people. I remember working on the chapter when she heard that there was a problem with cholera in Amiens, and when she heard about it, she called up her private train, got to Amiens. Announced to the hospital they had to change everything they were doing, the question of hygiene. She went through all the wards, talked to all the patients, realized there were orphans from people who had died, made arrangements for their adoption. She and then got back on the train and went back to Paris. And I thought, how do you get a hospital to change its whole idea of hygiene? How do you organize all of this essentially in one day and go home? Then probably change clothes another two times.
just, I mean, it goes to show, because I think a lot of people have this conception. I mean, I from what I've read, and I have done a little bit of research into her after receiving the book, and I find a lot of what people, the common misconceptions of her, is she was attractive, she wore dresses, she was fashionable, and not that that's a misconception, but that is the only thing that's focused on.
Yes, no, you're right about that. And maybe that partially explains why she has been forgotten to a certain extent in history because of her beauty and her success as a fashion promoter worked against her in the long run. But in reality, the fashion aspect, the changing clothes, those clothes were chosen the day before. They were organized by her staff, and she had a dress. She had a closet above her bedroom, in the Tuileries palace, which operated on a sort of dumb waiter principle. And every morning, that came down with four dress dummies on it with the clothes she was going to wear for the day. So some time was saved there, I guess. But the other thing is that every 6 months, she gave away all the clothes she'd worn, usually to her maids, who sold them or adapted them for their own use. And then she bought a new wardrobe. So the clothes were b being recycled constantly, and they were being reused, the fabrics. Which explains to a certain extent why you don't see many examples of those very elaborate gowns today. There are only a few that remain, and those are on exhibition right now in Paris at the Petit Palais Museum, and a retrospective of the House of Worth of the British designer. And these are very, very fragile. But the really ironic thing about it was that she was not interested in clothes. She wasn't interested in fashion. As a child, she just wore whatever she could find. She happily put on if the stable boy had outgrown his trousers, she pulled them on so she could go riding. But it was the idea of marketing France, the idea of presenting it as a strong country that made her do this, that made her continue to do it throughout her reign. And once she was in exile, she never wore those kinds of gowns again. She wore very fine clothes, but they were all black and they were no longer this super glamorous aspect of her life. But so she wasn't really a fashion plate so much as a brand ambassador.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. I mean, what do you think? Like, do you agree with me on that type of a common misconception is to do with the fact that she was sort of focused, she's been looked back in history as one particular thing rather than the whole compass of what she actually achieved in her lifetime.
Yes, I do agree with you that that made a difference. She was painted so many times, and there were so many beautiful portraits of her, which the government of France used as well, because as we wrote about it in the book, she was not the first choice of the country to become empress, but Napoleon III was fixed on her. He was, well, he saw her, and well, what can I say? Lust kicked in, and he made it very clear that he was not going to marry anyone else. But he did it very subtly. He pretended that, oh, there's this princess over here I might like, or et cetera, until it got to the point where he felt the freedom to say, no, I'm going to marry this Spanish aristocrat. That's it. But then he had to sell her to the country. And one of the ways he did it was having many, many paintings of her done, having copies of those paintings done, and then having them distributed throughout the country. So that there she was, the image of beauty and all of the things that people really want to project onto France and onto themselves. And it was right there before them in this, in the person of this woman, even if that was not the real woman.
No, and I mean, I found that a bit strange because the fact that she wasn't French either, she was Spanish, but yet she sold France. And I get that with that conception of having to sell her to your own people, in the sense that being British right now, we have an American princess who, for some reason, the British people don't seem to like quite much. I have my own opinion on that, but reminds me very much of Wallace Simpson in the 1930s. But again, but I, that is a thing. I mean, British people now, I would say, generally aren't as fussed about the royal family as they were 100 years ago. But yet, we still have that feeling when an outsider comes into the royal family of, hang on a minute, she's not English. And I think that does have something to do with it. And I think, obviously, you're talking here 150 years ago. I can believe that the French were exactly the same.
Yeah,
Obviously, the French monarchy ended in the 1790s, but obviously, we're talking a little bit, not too far afterwards. I mean, again, another lady in French history is Marie Antoinette. I mean, to be honest, when I first got this book, and I'm showing you, but no one else can see it, but I'm showing you the book. When I first saw the cover, that's who I thought it was Marie Antoinette. And then I looked at it and went, that's not Marie Antoinette. But I don't know if that is because of the gowns, because of the lavish looks, that pristine having to look perfect, whereas I think Marie Antoinette had a very similar type of look. Or whether it's the fact that, like you said earlier, that women in history have been lost, and the first person that you look at when you think of a French lady in from the 1980, oh, sorry, the eight, yeah, 1980s, 1980, 1800, 17, 1800s, you go to Marie Antoinette because she's the most famous. And I think, did she model herself on her? Did she know anything about her? Do we
She
know?
did. She had almost an obsessive interest in Marie Antoinette, partly because when she became empress, she worried that she.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. And that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-Grainger, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at freestylelibre.us.
For prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
Might suffer the same fate as Marie Antoinette.
Yeah.
And it was something that nagged at her throughout her reign. And in addition, she felt that Marie Antoinette had been underrated in many ways, that she had been underappreciated, because Eugenie took over what were called the maternal societies, which were to protect women and babies, newborn babies. And these were something Marie Antoinette had created. And as she began to work with it, she felt that this was totally neglected in the story of Marie Antoinette, that she had done all these other things, that she had been so concerned about families and children. And it was something that Eugenie could identify with, that she took on herself and expanded and used as a basis for many other programs that she established, many other schools, many other things like the Hospital for Women and a home for girls who were without families, etc.
I mean, it's crazy that you sort of, like you said, it's the political aspect of her career as well is fascinating. But I find it crazy that she had that fear of what happened to Marie. I totally understand why you'd have that fear, because of obviously the French Revolution was huge, but it was technically to depose the monarchy, and she wasn't a monarchy, but they were kind of self-appointed, weren't they, the Bonapartes? Yeah. They were a self-appointed monarchy. So I do understand that, and especially when they lost the wars. Again, I can see the French people turning. I mean, the French do love a good riot. I can understand the fear there, but it's a scary thought to. And I think that just from what you're saying, that might be why she put so much work into going to hospitals and working with poor, working with the orphans, putting herself out there doing charitable work, which in reality, Marie Antoinette didn't do. You know, she was kind of the opposite.
The other aspect of it is that when she married Napoleon III, he said to her, "We have to move quickly because look back at the recent history of France. Nobody has lasted more than 20 years. So that's what we have to think about." And they did. They moved very, very quickly to try and make France a more modern country, to try and put the economy on a stable footing, and to do all the other things that were Eugenie's plans, her goals, her dreams, as I said, particularly in women's areas, the whole idea of women's education and care for women in all kinds of ways, in employment, etc.
I mean, her influence is crazy when you talk about a political arena where essentially women weren't, I would even go as far as saying weren't allowed. I wanted to say weren't involved, but it was weren't allowed. You know, women weren't. And for her to have that sort of a role, what do you think, like, the effects of modern day sort of reflect from what she did?
The major thing again is women are educated, and you see women in all aspects of France today. You see them in all aspects of business and politics more and more. And of course, it meant opening up all kinds of opportunities of employment, because you said women weren't allowed, and that's absolutely true. They were held back by law. Her uncle by marriage, Napoleon I Bonaparte, in his code, kept women from owning property, from having their own finances, from being allowed to do anything essentially without the permission of their father first and then their husbands. They were totally second-class citizens, or half a step removed from being a slave. I see your cat.
Yeah, sorry. She just jumped up.
So you're absolutely right. Women were not allowed to do that. They were not allowed to own a business. They weren't allowed to participate in public life at all. So from that standpoint, she accomplished a major revolution in the life of France as a whole, but particularly specifically in the lives of females in France. And that of course is evident today. But her interests in the technology and in scientific development also had a huge influence. She was very taken by the Crystal Palace in London and thought that was the style of architecture that could really be put to good use. And so today in France, the buildings you see, such as some of the train stations, the old market at Rungis, etc., built with the steel and glass construction, were because she pushed for that as a hygienic and a wonderful way to open up buildings for people to have a more fresh air, etc. And this again, and the parks, etc., all of this is because of her influence on her country, on the political landscape of France.
I mean, she sounds, I mean, absolutely wonderful. I mean, I find when you're saying things, I know you, for I'm assuming for a lot of the listeners as well, I don't think people can comprehend that in sort of the 1850s, 1860s, that women weren't allowed to do things. I mean, I just find it fascinating when you're saying things like, they couldn't do this without their dad saying they can, or they couldn't do this without. And you sort of think, I do you know what? I can't even tell my wife to make me a cup of tea without getting told off. You know, I don't understand how it was ever like that. It just seems so backwards. But that's, you know, it's nice to see we've come a long way.
I certainly agree with that.
Yeah, it's yeah. I find it. I mean, you ask anybody, I mean, I would say majority of people nowadays, it's the woman that runs the relationship. It definitely is in my house. So I can't imagine that around that sort of time. But
Maybe we are underestimating a bit also how clever some of those women were. They
absolutely.
probably did a good job running their households, but that was pretty much the limit of what they were able to get by with.
Yeah.
Because even if their husband said, "Please, take care of the finances here, because I don't know what you're doing," it was certainly something that he wouldn't admit to anybody else, and she wouldn't be able to talk about either. It was definitely a situation in which the woman was meant to stay home, and that was it.
It's very medieval, isn't it?
Absolutely,
Yeah.
absolutely.
But
But France was very slow in giving women the right to vote. It did not happen till 1946 after
wow.
World. There, yeah, exactly. Wow. And meanwhile, Eugénie was living in exile in England and busy supporting the suffragists in the UK, having them supporting them financially and supporting them socially at lunch, even though she was very careful not to offend Victoria by being an active supporter on the streets with the marches, etc. But France had voted for the rights of women to vote, who I think as early as World War I, but the war interfered, the bill never went through, and it was not finalized then until de Gaulle was president in 1946.
So
Extraordinary.
if she was living in England, she would actually have been able to vote because I believe we passed the law in 1918,
Yeah, she
just
could have
after the
voted.
First World War. So she'd have been able to vote in England, but not in France, which is
Right.
mad. Well, I mean, again, I find that really, really strange because we're talking here where the women weren't allowed to vote until 1918 in England. We had a queen for 70 or 60 odd years prior to that, who was the head of our country, and yet women weren't allowed to do things like that. And I find that fascinating because to me, when you've got your head of state is a woman, you would think that women would be pushed to the forefront. But obviously, that wasn't the case under Victoria. I mean,
No.
even as far, you know, the Crystal Palace that you were on about, I mean, that was created by Albert as well, wasn't it? He designed that and built that. I mean, shockingly, it's not there anymore. But
I know.
I'd love
At
it if it
least
was. I've seen pictures. It looked pretty impressive, like a big greenhouse, really.
yeah.
But
So
it's
you still have, but you have Q, so that's okay.
I've only been there a couple of times, though, believe it or not. But we do have right next to Kew Gardens is the National Library, the archives, the National Archives Library. So I've been there a few times just to do some research and things like that. So that's quite good. But yeah, the botanical gardens and stuff at Kew are amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Somewhere I'd like to go back. It's but it, in regards to, so what was the, for you personally, when we talk about her influence in fashion, in perfume, in science, in political aspects, in women's rights, I mean, just that alone is a massive list to reel off. What do you think personally was like her biggest achievement for you that you can see now and look back and go, that's, if I could do one thing, that's.
I do think it is the women's education. If every year you see the list of people who have earned their BAC in France, and it goes on, I've forgotten how many thousand women got their BAC this year, their degree from finishing their secondary education, but thousands of them. And this means that because Eugénie got one woman to go take the BAC exam and pass it with absolutely perfect scores, things began to happen. And from that one woman, now it's these thousands every year who go on to become scientists, who go on to become writers, who go on to become, if wives, if they spend their time as homemakers, become tremendous homemakers and mothers and create children who are more aware of what their possibilities are. But now we have the possibilities.
I mean, in political aspects, I mean, has, I don't know, so I'm asking, has France ever had a female president or prime minister? I don't know how they do it over there.
France has had two female prime ministers, most recently Elizabeth Borne, who was a prime minister under the president Macron. But prime ministers don't necessarily have a long tenure. And she didn't, but she's still in government. She's still a minister.
I didn't know you had a prime minister and a president. Didn't.
Yep.
Okay.
France does.
So the president, I'm assuming, is the top dog, and the prime minister's like the number two.
Yeah, that's about right.
That makes me feel really bad that we have a prime minister then, and there's the technically number two across the world. Has there ever been a female president then?
No,
No.
not yet.
I know they were close to one. I know, I don't know anything about it, but Marine Le Pen, that's the only, I only know her name.
Yeah,
I know she was close.
there have been female contenders.
Yeah. I mean, it would be nice, I think. I mean, like I said, Britain, we've had three female prime ministers, so yeah, we're up there. America still hasn't had one yet, I think.
No, we haven't managed to elect a female president yet.
I want to see Michelle Obama do it personally. I think she'd be great. Anyone other than Meghan Markle, to be should I say Meghan
Already
with?
taken. Yeah, she's already taken.
Yeah. So, but I mean, it's. I mean, the political landscape right now is absolutely crazy. I mean, to be honest, it'd probably be better to go back to the 1800s right now. At least the political landscape was a little bit simpler. I mean, right now, our country's gone. I know America's fighting its own battles. The whole world seems to have gone a bit crazy right now. So I think it's nice to me when you look back at history and you can see positives. And this book is definitely a positive. It's focusing on a woman who's been lost to history, who has influenced a lot of things that we don't realize, and had a fascinating life. I mean, 94 years old is a good innings, is what we say in this country. You know, that's,
yes.
You know, she's done some fascinating stuff. I mean, from the 1820s, she lived through the entire Victorian era and the First World War. I mean, absolutely fascinating story. And I think it's important nowadays to look back on people like this, because I always find when you look through my shows, and a lot of my listeners will agree to this, we do some really, really big shows. We do some really big parts of history. But I think the ones that get the more traction are the smaller stories, the ones that people haven't heard about. And this, when I saw this, when I got sent the copy of the book, and I, like I said, immediately I thought it's Marie Antoinette. And I thought, oh, I've been looking to do that. And then I read it and I thought, this is not Marie Antoinette, but this is, I would say, probably more fascinating because it's not someone we know. And these are the things that scream to my listeners, are the people throughout history that have been lost throughout history and shouldn't be lost. And it's thanks to authors like yourself that bring these people back into the forefront. And I think you've done a brilliant job. It's a great, great book. I mean, some of the reviews as well. I mean, we're talking about New York bestsellers that have come out and given you probably, they're not star reviews, but they're probably 10 star reviews. I mean, they're absolutely fantastic. So yeah, it's a great book. It's really.
Well, thank you. That's really a tremendous compliment. And I think that it's a tremendous compliment, especially to Eugenie, whose life was such a mixture of triumph and tragedy. And the fact that she survived all those years, having gone through the horror of losing her husband and her son fighting for the British in South Africa,
yeah,
makes her even more attractive to me, to see that kind of resilience. And the other thing that I think is really terrific about her, which I think every British woman can appreciate today, is her athletic ability and her love of athletics. Now that the British team has won the Euro,
yes,
I mean, real lionesses. That's what she
won it back to back. They made the men's team look a bit embarrassing, to be honest. But no, it's not. It's nice to have it. Football's come home again, so. But yeah. No, I mean, I totally agree. But is the book available? I mean, I don't mean this in a, we get a lot of books that are pre-ordered. Is this one available now? Is it on sale?
Yes, it is. It was officially released July 9th in the United States. So yeah, it's available on all kinds of online sellers.
Yeah.
The publisher in the US is HarperCollins, Hanover Square imprint, but Duckworth has bought the rights in the UK.
Okay.
So the British edition will be out in February of 2026.
Okay, that's good. I mean, I would say 90% of my listeners are from America. So if you are in America, that'd be get yourself a copy. What I'll do when I post the episode, I'll normally put a link, normally like an Amazon link or a bookstore link in there for people as well. So I'll definitely make sure that goes on there. So honestly, thank you very, very much for joining us. I really, really appreciate it, and keep up the good work.
Well, thank you very much, and certainly our pleasure to have an opportunity to write about Eugenie, and now to be able to chat with you about her and all she did.
Well, thank you for your time, and we'll get this episode out as soon as possible for you, and I'll send you a copy of it.
Okay, thanks very much.
No problem. Thank you. Have a nice evening.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.